Case number 14-7084. Henry Barry John Nace, respondent. Mr. Nace for the respondent, Mr. Mills for the amicus curiae.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Nace here on behalf of Respondent Barry J. Nace, who is present in the courtroom today. Just by way of brief introduction to Mr. Nace, who's been a member of this bar for several decades, he's the only person twice elected president of the Trial Lawyers Association of Metropolitan Washington, D.C. He's a past president of what was then the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. He was president of the National Board of Legal Specialty Certification, also an elected position by
I think the order establishing oral argument was pretty clear that we want to talk about the legal issues involved, and I don't believe those touched upon any legal issues.
Well, only to the extent that mitigation of punishment, and that's something that is an issue in this case, which, Your Honor, goes to the infirmity of proof at the lower court. And these are all facts that you wouldn't know if you read the West Virginia Supreme Court's opinion in this case. And those are relative factors that are outlined in the court's opinion but aren't addressed.
Supreme Court of West Virginia did consider Mr. Nace's background for some time and weighed that, did it not?
When you look through the opinion, Your Honor, no, you don't see that they said, other than to say that he's been practicing for years and is esteemed by his peers. That was all the consideration given. There was no consideration given to a 40-year history.
Let me ask you a question. Your argument is that we have the right to determine what the appropriate penalty should be under our rules.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that mean if we think it was too little a suspension that we can agree to suspend for a much longer period of time?
I don't believe so because it is a reciprocal disciplinary proceeding.
But your argument is we can evaluate whether it's the proper penalty. Does that mean we can also increase the penalty if we think it's inadequate?
Well, if you look at the basis for our challenge to it here and our argument here, the four categories that are provided for in the rules, my reading of them, Your Honor, is that they provide the respondent an opportunity to have less punishment or no punishment.
It doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't.
But it says whatever punishment we think is appropriate, doesn't it?
No, it says, it actually says this court shall impose the identical discipline unless the attorney demonstrates or this court is satisfied that the procedure was so lacking in notice or opportunity to be heard.
There are other provisions, aren't there?
There are four provisions that are provided for.
And one provision gives us authority to come up with what we think is the appropriate penalty, doesn't it?
The last, number four says the misconduct warrants substantially different discipline.
That's what I mean.
But I think that still falls under that the court shall impose the identical discipline unless the attorney demonstrates and the court is satisfied that the misconduct warrants substantially different discipline. So I think under that reading of it, it's allowing the respondent to show that different discipline should apply. I don't think the respondent would make the argument that more discipline is necessary. So I'm not sure that I do agree with Your Honor on that. This is a reciprocal proceeding, and the reason for that is that this court hasn't held an investigation of the facts. We're taking the record as it is. Now, if this court wanted to appoint a panel to conduct an investigation, we would welcome that, quite honestly. We would welcome somebody taking a fresh look at the facts in this case. Our position from a legal standpoint has been the same throughout. We don't understand why nobody wants to look at the relationship between a trustee and special counsel that is detailed and outlined by a federal statute.
Didn't Mr. Nace fail to tell the truth for at least 18 months
In what regard? Because that is something
you're
that keeps...
You're asking me questions.
I'm rhetorically...
It's in the West Virginia Supreme Court.
So one of, if not the only, argument the West Virginia Supreme Court makes in that regard is that when asked if there was a settlement in this case, Mr. Nace responded by saying there wasn't a settlement, there was a jury verdict. Now,
what about the September 2006 communication?
What the letter says that was an issue in this case is that I need to talk to your bankruptcy lawyer. Let's keep in mind, there was no evidence anywhere. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that didn't happen. There's no evidence one way or the other. What we do know is that at the time of the deposition of Mrs. Miller, the client in the underlying case, she testified she had been discharged. So contrary to the suggestion in the amicus brief that there was evidence that Mr. Nace did not follow up on that letter, there is no evidence. And the burden on the West Virginia proceeding was clear and convincing evidence. So how you go from no evidence to clear and convincing evidence on that point is beyond me. And that's why one of the reasons we think there's been an infirmity of proof in this case. There is no evidence that there was not a conversation with the bankruptcy counsel and with Mr. Nace. Let's keep in mind, the original affidavit, the application to employ that the trustee submitted, says right in it, to retain for a personal injury matter coming out of an automobile accident. Mr. Nace didn't handle that matter. And after that communication, merely sending the affidavit to Mr. Nace.
What do you mean he didn't handle that matter? I thought he did.
He did not. This was a medical malpractice case. Mm-hmm. The affidavit that was asked.
I'm sorry. Is this a new argument you're making now, that he was retained for a different case?
Absolutely not. We've made this argument throughout. In fact, in the West Virginia Supreme Court.
Are you saying that the medical malpractice case was different from the automobile accident case?
What we're saying, Your Honor.
There are two different matters?
What we're saying.
I thought it all arose out of an automobile accident.
It did not arise out of an automobile accident case. And therein lies one of the problems we've had. If the trustee had ever communicated with Mr. Nace, ever, until after the disbursement of funds, we might not be having this discussion.
Why was it the obligation of Mr. Nace to communicate with his client?
Because he never was retained to have a client.
Oh, he certainly was. He signed the stipulation.
He signed
an affidavit.
He signed an affidavit that says...
Well, the West Virginia Supreme Court says that created an attorney-client relationship.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. Number one, the affidavit says that Mr. Nace is willing to be employed if the court permits him to do so and the trustee retains him. That didn't happen because there was never a communication with Mr. Nace after the bankruptcy court said, sign the application to employ.
West Virginia Supreme Court made a different decision on that as to whether an attorney-client relationship was created.
Yes and no.
Don't we have to respect the West Virginia Supreme Court?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because this is why it matters. What the West Virginia Supreme Court found was that an attorney-client relationship existed under their common law. The relationship between trustee and special counsel, something that no court has considered in this matter at this point, it's not common law. In fact, it's not even attorney-client relationship. It's one of the trustee who has a duty to supervise the employees that the special counsel that he retains. In fact, Your Honor, if you look at Section 327, which is the only statute that authorizes a trustee to go out and hire somebody to represent the estate in a matter like this, it specifically says, and this is 11 U.S.C. 327E, the trustee, with the court's approval, may employ for a specified special purpose other than to represent the trustee in conducting the case. Other than to represent the trustee, this is not an attorney-client relationship that's developed, and it's not contemplated to be such a relationship. This is why this court does not have to adhere to the West Virginia Supreme Court's finding, because the West Virginia Supreme Court applied common law and it did not look at all. It doesn't even consider federal bankruptcy law. And that's the only place that authorizes a trustee to hire special counsel. You must look at the federal law in understanding this relationship. And it wasn't done.
When the trustee hires special counsel, to whom does the special counsel owe a fiduciary duty?
Well, I would argue that the special counsel assuming that they've been retained properly, owes it to the estate, to the bankruptcy estate. Well, the trustee has a fiduciary relationship, too. The trustee is not the estate. The trustee has a fiduciary.
But he represents the estate, right?
He does.
Okay,
yes.
So the fiduciary relationship is to the trustee.
That's fine, but that doesn't create an attorney-client relationship.
It doesn't?
No.
What is it?
Because an attorney-client, this creates
a
relationship.
A fiduciary relationship that is not an attorney-client?
This is the same type of relationship that if an attorney brought in appellate counsel to argue a case. This is hiring a special lawyer to handle a different matter. That's why the section says that you can't bring in someone to actually handle the case. The trustee has to be involved.
So when the special counsel come in, who is the special counsel's client?
The special counsel's client is the estate, the bankruptcy estate.
You're going around in circles.
You're going around in circles. I don't understand that. If you brought in as counsel, even if it's under someone above you who has a larger role, I don't understand how you don't have a relationship that is attorney-client relationship
because
to the person for whom you're arguing. When we bring in counsel here to argue on behalf of folks, they're in some kind of a relationship I would have assumed was attorney-client.
But
Even though they didn't try the case and they're not even retained with money, they're representing people.
The Supreme Court of West Virginia's opinion found a violation of an attorney-client relationship between Mr. Trumbull and Mr. Nace.
Yeah.
There is no attorney-client relationship between those two entities. There may be a relationship. There may be a relationship between them. But as far as ethical proceedings and finding violation of the rules, you can't. Moreover, more importantly than that even, the analysis was not done under federal law. And there was no consideration of federal bankruptcy law that creates the relationship. In other words, the West Virginia Supreme Court said, we get to decide what the relationship is, regardless of 11 United States Code 327E. Now, how do they get to do that when the only statute that authorizes the relationship at all is 327? In fact, this matter should be considered by the federal bankruptcy court, and that court hasn't made any ruling, let alone one of impropriety or ethics violations.
It's waiting for this proceeding, right?
Well, I don't know what it's waiting for. It's waiting for a trial.
There's in the brief.
No, not the West Virginia bankruptcy court. The West Virginia bankruptcy court, we do have there's an adversary proceeding pending, but there's no issues in that case of ethics. That's not even been raised. That's
no,
simply to collect
question
money.
The question there is whether or not Mr. Nace and Mrs. Miller took too much money that might have been owed to debtors of the estate. Is that correct?
No, not. I don't think that's
you're
exactly
saying,
correct.
You're saying that he never asserted that there was a settlement?
No, I didn't say that, Your Honor. What I said is that to suggest that the statement that there was not a settlement but was a jury verdict, look, it was a mistake, but there was never any dispute. There was never any misleading as far as what the dollar amount was. If you look at that letter that says there was a jury verdict, the amount collected in the jury verdict after the jury verdict and the judgment entered was a total of $500,000. That was disclosed from the minute the letter went out to the trustee that was the total amount, and it's not disputed that was the total amount. Moreover, and importantly, the total amount owed the debtors was just less than $13,000. And in addition, Mr. Nace... The creditors. Yeah. In addition...
So the creditors are owed $13,000 that they never got, huh?
That's right. And that money, Your Honor, has been deposited into the court registry for three and a half years.
I thought there was a settlement apart from the jury amount.
There was, and that's what I'm trying to...
I thought they said that they were misleading, whatever you call it, that he did not report that, and that twice. There was not any settlement when, in fact, there was a settlement.
And I guess that's what I'm saying, Your Honor. There was a mistake in the letter that came... There was a letter written from Mr. Nace to the trustee.
Saying there was
said,
no settlement.
That's right.
That wasn't true.
But what I'm saying is it was a mistake to suggest that it's unethical or misleading when the total dollar amount disclosed is no different. In other words, if Mr. Nace had said, I didn't collect the $75,000 settlement, all we collected was $425,000, that would be misleading. What you have is a trial lawyer who tried a case 2 years before that, 3 years before that maybe, went up on appeal and had a $500,000 jury verdict affirmed, you don't remember the partial settlements. And so the fact that he wrote a letter saying, I don't know what you're talking about settlement, I remember we had a jury verdict in this case for $500,000. Your Honor, if that's misleading, if that's something, but if that, misleading or is it a mistake?
I totally understand your concern that attorneys are busy sometimes and don't always take account of the details of what's in the office, but that also puts us in jeopardy if we do that too.
Is it an unethical, misleading, or is it a mistake that was cured by the fact that the full amount was disclosed? Nobody's arguing otherwise than that. The full amount was disclosed.
But counsel, that is only one point. As I read the West Virginia Supreme Court, they pointed out that your client lied repeatedly concerning various matters involving this investigation.
And I guess I've always wondered, what was the lie? What is this big lie that happened? Is the lie that he said that the $500,000 was jury verdict?
I'm talking about the other matters, the communications. Was it September 2006 letter?
That there was one letter in the file? And you're right, Your Honor. I mean, this was a file that by the time this all happened had been in storage for years.
But it's under investigation.
Yes.
It's a little thick to say, well, I forgot about that letter.
Well, did anybody put in the West Virginia opinion?
You're not normally authorized to ask questions of the judges.
Well, I'm sorry. Maybe I felt like I was on Jeopardy. I was phrasing it like a question. But the West Virginia Supreme Court does not state in its opinion that, in fact, with regard to the going down to bar counsel, when Mr. Nace first went and met with bar counsel in Charleston, he took all the documents he could find when he was asked to go. And he told bar counsel, if you think you need anything else, let me know. My file is several banker's boxes. I pulled it from storage. Let me know if you think you need something else. Nobody ever asked him for anything else. Bar counsel drove him to the airport that day and said, don't worry about it. We'll let you know if we need anything else.
Well, how would people know if there was anything else if they're trying to figure out what there was?
Well,
that doesn't make any sense.
I don't disagree, but Your Honor,
the argument doesn't make sense. I don't want you to think it makes sense. It doesn't make sense. I understand your argument, Jim, but that one makes no sense.
No, but here's why I
ask someone to give me all of what's relevant and they give you less than all. How is that person supposed to know that you gave less than all when they're trying to figure out the all?
Here's why it makes sense. Here's why it's relevant, Your Honor, to this argument. I started off by talking about Mr. Nace's history with the bar. And it's relevant to that point. The court has sat here, and the West Virginia Supreme Court has said Mr. Nace was dishonest by clear and convincing evidence. And this is why the 40-year history of service to the bar and an unblemished record is important. Because is it more likely that he was dishonest when there is no allegation of financial gain? There's nothing in this case that suggests improper financial gain. That's never been asserted, and it wouldn't be based in any reality. Is it more likely
that's a question for the bankruptcy court, isn't it?
No, it's not.
In other words, if the trustee in bankruptcy makes a claim for the proceeds or part of the proceeds of the either the settlement or the jury verdict in behalf of the estate, then there would be something at stake, wouldn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's a different statement, though.
What?
That's a different statement. Mr. Nace's fee.
No, that would be something. In other words, there would be a clawback possibility, and money would be come from Mr. Nace or Mrs. Miller or both into the estate.
Sure, that's right, Mr. That's
so
why
there is money at stake, isn't there?
Well, but what I said is that there was never an allegation that his fee would have been different, and
well,
it wouldn't
have
been.
Well, that's a separate question. Maybe he wasn't entitled to. He got approximately half. 50% of the jury verdict. I saw that.
40% plus the reimbursement of costs.
Okay, was that it? All right. But it's not clear at all what the trustee in bankruptcy would make a claim on. That's still a lie.
Oh, no. Oh, no, Your Honor. I disagree. I entirely disagree. Yes, no, that's not correct. If, in fact, the court were to say Mr. Nace was retained.
Which court?
Any court. If the court were to say Mr. Nace was properly retained, we dispute that he was, then Mr. Nace would have been entitled to 40% plus costs, exactly the amount.
Well, now, Mrs. Miller may not have been.
That may be, but Mrs. Miller wasn't joined as a party.
Well, she's a party in the bankruptcy.
She's been discharged.
She has?
She was discharged before the medical malpractice suit was filed.
Hmm. So who pays the debtors?
Well, that's why Mr. Nace that's why Mr. Nace took it upon himself to deposit the money into the court registry 3 years ago to say, if I am in fact found responsible.
That was after the ethics issue, right?
That was as soon as the dollar amount was brought to his attention. No, it was not before. It was not after the ethics. It was during the simultaneous proceeding of the adversary proceeding and the ethics proceeding. In fact, we had to go through discovery and deposition discovery of the trustee to find out the dollar amount. It was never disclosed. It was never sent in those letters saying, where's my money? It was never disclosed that we're talking about $13,000. Within 48 hours of finding out the amount that the creditors were owed, Mr. Nace filed a motion and deposited the amount with the court to say, if I was wrong, if I'm found wrong by the bankruptcy court, the money is there. Now, is that dishonest? Is that not taking responsibility? There's a difference between not taking responsibility.
West Virginia Supreme Court did not rely on that.
They don't even mention it.
I know.
They don't even mention it.
It's not relevant.
It is relevant because this court can consider those factors in determining if the proof was sufficient.
I'm not sure if we consider those factors. It's to your advantage.
Well, Your Honor, when an attorney finds out of a potential mistake, and that attorney then takes the funds that may be due and puts them into a court, deposits them, and says, I'm going to go through the justice system, and if I'm found to be wrong, I put that there. With all due respect to the West Virginia court and to any court, this is a textbook case of how you should handle a situation like this. Mr. Nace has gone through, he should be allowed to defend himself, but at the same time, he's deposited the money into the court. So that's there, so that the creditors can be made whole. The question is, why has the trustee not tried to resolve it to get the creditors paid? Why is the trustee's law firm billed $100,000 on this file at this point when the money's been sitting in the court? There are all sorts of problems with this case. And Mr. Nace,
thank you very much. We have your argument. We'll give you back 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Christopher Mills, court-appointed amicus. We've heard a lot today about Mr. Trumbull, the bankruptcy trustee, but this case is ultimately not about Mr. Trumbull or about preemption or about Section 327. Instead, it's about a unanimous, well-supported state Supreme Court determination that Mr. Nace committed at least 6 ethical violations. And it's about Rule 4, which requires this court to impose identical discipline in all but the most extraordinary circumstances. Every court
can we raise the discipline?
Yes, Your Honor, you can. Under Rule 4C, the court can impose different discipline if the attorney demonstrates or the court is satisfied that different discipline is warranted. Every court to consider this matter has imposed an identical 120-day suspension, and this court should do the same. My friend today repeated something he said in his reply brief, that there's no evidence, Judge Silverman, you asked about the September 2006 letter from Mr. Nace to Ms. Miller inquiring whether she had a bankruptcy attorney and asking for that person to contact her. My friend says that, quote, there is no evidence that there was not a follow-up conversation with the bankruptcy attorney. He said the same thing in his reply brief, quote, there simply was no testimony one way or the other that Mr. Nace did or did not follow up with the bankruptcy counsel. Your Honors, that's just not accurate. There was uncontroverted testimony that Mr. Nace did not follow up with the bankruptcy counsel. In fact, the testimony came from Mr. Nace himself. Supplemental appendix, page 252, line 3, Mr. Nace under oath, quote, I never talked to her bankruptcy attorney. He says it over and over again. Supplemental appendix, page 247, quote, I didn't even hear anything from her attorney that she had, this guy, whatever his name is, O'Brien. His own proposed finding of fact, supplemental appendix, page 72, Mr. Nace had, quote, no contact with Mr. O'Brien, Ms. Miller's bankruptcy counsel. This led the West Virginia Supreme Court to decide, appendix page 14, that Mr. Nace did not follow up with Ms. Miller or her bankruptcy counsel after sending that September 2006 letter. My friend admits that it was a mistake and an error to say that there was no settlement when, in fact, there was a settlement. But the West Virginia Supreme Court found that Mr. Nace was knowingly untruthful about this fact. And so what my friend's asking this court to do is review a credibility determination of the state hearing panel and the state Supreme Court. And under Rule 4, I don't think that's this court's appropriate role. Moreover, I note that the D.C. Court of Appeals carefully examined these issues and found the same. On the issue of whether an attorney-client relationship was formed, again, the D.C. Court of Appeals explained that under their rules, just like the West Virginia rules, there was a client desire to employ an attorney, and the attorney consented to be employed and to provide legal services. Mr. Trumbull clearly expressed his desire to employ Mr. Nace by sending him a letter asking that Mr. Nace sign an affidavit accepting employ as special counsel. If the affidavit, the application, and the proposed order met his approval, Mr. Nace expressed his consent by signing that affidavit, sending it back. The affidavit on appendix page 4 is a formal document, makes very clear that he's consenting to provide legal services on behalf of the estate. It's notarized.
Isn't there an argument that that was conditioned on the bankruptcy court authorizing that transaction?
Yes, Your Honor. The West Virginia Supreme Court and the D.C. Court of Appeals explained that assuming the order was conditioned on entry of the order, that order was in fact entered in the bankruptcy court. So the court can assume that it was conditional on the entry of the actual order of employment, and that is what happened.
Suppose the bankruptcy court were to determine subsequently that no attorney-client relationship was established.
Well, I don't think that's likely to happen, as the bankruptcy court has already found a denying summary judgment. Footnote 6 of the bankruptcy court denial of summary judgment, the court acknowledges that West Virginia found that an attorney-client relationship existed.
Is it still open? Is it still open before the bankruptcy court as to whether there was an attorney-client relationship?
That doesn't seem to be an open issue in the bankruptcy court.
Suppose it were. And suppose the bankruptcy judge concluded there was no attorney-client relationship.
I think it would still not raise a conflict between federal and state law. For state law purposes, there would have been an attorney-client relationship form, and as a member of the state bar of West Virginia, Mr. Nace would be subject to the West Virginia disciplinary authorities there, even if under federal law there was not an attorney-client relationship.
You wouldn't have a preemption question?
I don't think there would necessarily be a conflict there if the federal law required something that the state law required him not to do. In those circumstances, there might be preemption. But just the fact that for state law purposes, there may have been an attorney-client relationship, and for federal law purposes, there may not have been, I don't think that alone would raise a preemption problem. As for the issue of whether the application that Mr. Nace received said vehicular accident rather than medical malpractice, it's undisputed that all the lawyers understood what it meant. As an initial matter, Mr. Nace claimed for some time that he didn't even receive this application, so it's a bit much now to assert that he saw this application and because of the application didn't realize what he was being hired to do. But even assuming he had seen it, he testified, supplemental appendix page 351, I didn't make any issue of it. It just wasn't important to me at the time. His co-counsel, Mr. Burke, testified to the same. All the lawyers understood what they were receiving and what they were signing. And as the D.C. Court of Appeals explained in footnote 4 of their opinion, there's no reason why that minor error would affect the question whether an attorney-client relationship had formed. As for the issue of whether Mr. Nace was Mr. Trumbull's attorney or the bankruptcy estate's attorney, again, that really makes no difference to the ultimate findings of misconduct here. It's essentially undisputed that Mr. Nace failed to contact Mr. Trumbull on behalf of Mr. Trumbull or the bankruptcy estate for a period of over 3.5 years.
Well, wait a minute. I don't understand your last statement. It doesn't matter whether Mr. Nace had an attorney-client relationship with Mr. Trumbull or not. I don't understand that point.
Well, I think the point is, and the D.C. Court of Appeals explained this at page 21 of their opinion, changing the identity of the client would not affect the West Virginia Supreme Court's conclusion that Mr. Nace failed to fulfill his professional responsibilities to either the estate or Mr. Trumbull by timely contacting Mr. Trump.
I don't see how can there be a difference between the trustee and the estate? I don't get it.
I don't think there is. I think that's right. I don't think there is.
There is no difference.
No.
The estate is the trustee. The trustee represents the estate.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I agree. It doesn't make sense to say that, for instance, Mr. Nace failed to contact the estate for over 3.5 years.
There is no estate.
Right.
It's the trustee.
Right. That's right. So the point is that the conduct that formed the basis for the suspension in West Virginia is essentially conceded here. What Mr. Nace said is asking this court to make new credibility determinations and replace its judgment for that of the West Virginia Supreme Court, but under Rule 4 and this court's decisions in Sibley and Zradovich, that's not this court's role. It's conceded that Mr. Nace failed to contact Mr. Trumbull for over 3.5 years while the case was ongoing, that he failed to notify Mr. Trumbull regarding the settlement funds, that he sent a letter in December 2008 stating multiple times there was no settlement when, in fact, there was a settlement, and that he didn't bring relevant documents when subpoenaed and stated that he had not received some documents that he had received. These are essentially conceded. Mr. Nace does not contend there's any due process problem. Given the findings of misconduct, there'd be no grave injustice, and a 120-day suspension is appropriate given the misconduct found by the West Virginia Supreme Court, which included 6 separate ethical violations. This court has any additional questions?
Ms. Nace, we'll give you back a minute and a half.
Your Honor, the only point that I want to wrap up on, and I don't understand why we are all taking for granted, every court is taking for granted, that this is an attorney-client relationship without ever considering the relationship contemplated by the bankruptcy rules. It's just, it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened anywhere that this is a relationship, and it's in our brief. The analysis should have been conducted under the 5 series of rules. They were not. The West Virginia Supreme Court ignored, doesn't, it even says in its opinion, we are not making any determinations under bankruptcy law. The only law that permits an assistant trustee to go and retain special counsel, to even bring special counsel into a bankruptcy, is 327. The analysis must start with that relationship.
So where does it take you?
It takes you to a relationship that this was not an attorney-client relationship.
What is it about 327 that says it's not an attorney-client relationship?
Because it specifically says that under 327 that the counsel or that the trustee is not retaining counsel to represent him.
Read that. I don't remember that coming out exactly like that.
The trustee, with the court's approval, may employ for a specified special purpose, other than to represent the trustee in conducting the case, an attorney that has represented the debtor, if in the best interest of the estate, and if such attorney does not represent or hold any interest adverse to the debtor or to the estate with respect to the matter on which such attorney is to be employed.
I don't understand where that takes you.
It does not create an attorney-client.
I understand it.
It doesn't foreclose it.
I've been
sitting here perplexed about the argument, too. I don't see how that forecloses it.
So let me point to one other document.
It certainly says the person is not the trustee.
That's right.
I understand that.
What it also does is an attorney-client relationship contemplates one party in power over the other as far as the legal process, as far as understanding what's going on, as far as the obligations. What 327 says is that the trustee retains all the obligations to the estate, and that's in the handbook, the trustee handbook.
Is there any authority, any case law anywhere that supports your interpretation?
No, I haven't found any case law any which way, Your Honor. And we looked, and I don't see it any which way that says that, in fact, it is an attorney-client relationship either. But in this case, the trustee is the one charged with administering the estate. And the reason is that the trustee had an obligation. I know that it's easy to say that Mr. Nace doesn't want to talk about his actions, but the trustee, once the order entered permitting him to go employ special counsel, that's all it is. It's an order permitting him to employ special counsel. There was no communication after that order entered until after the disbursement. How could the trustee have employed special counsel without ever communicating with them. And these are determinations that go to whether there was an ethical violation. This is a very serious matter, obviously, that goes to the ethics of an attorney with 40-year history. So why not look at, was he properly retained by the sophisticated trustee whose duty it is to make sure these things happen? I mean, ask if the trustee had even done 1 ounce of his job and reached out one time, would the creditors have not been whole already?
Thank you. We have your argument. Thank you very much, Mr. Nace. Yeah. I said Mr. Mills, you were appointed by the court to help us as amicus curiae. We thank you very much for your assistance. With that, the case is submitted.